Famloy ang kawana katulor ali fataga. Famloy ang kawana katulor ali fataga. Famloy ang kawana katulor ali fataga.
Welcome to this, the 71st of the Cthulhu Podcasts. We're back on track today with the next part of Through the Brazilian Wilderness, which will be followed by a musical number, and of course the next part of our current Lovecraft story. Let's get started. Part 35 of Through the Brazilian Wilderness by Teddy Roosevelt. I alluded above to the queer custom these people of the interior of Brazil have of gelding their hunting dogs. This absurd habit is doubtless the chief reason why there are so few hounds worth their salt in the more serious kinds of hunting, where the quarry is the jaguar or the big peccary. Thus far, we had seen but one dog as good as the ordinary cougar hound or bear hound in such packs as those with which I had hunted in the Rockies or cane brakes of the lower Mississippi. It can hardly be otherwise, when every dog that shows himself worth anything is promptly put out of the category of breeders, the theory apparently being that the dog will then last longer. All the breeding is from worthless dogs, and no dog of proved worth leaves descendants. The country along this river is a fine natural cattle country, and some day it will surely see a great development. It was opened to development by Colonel Rondon only 5 or 6 years ago. Already an occasional cattle ranch is to be found along the banks. When railroads are built into these interior portions of the Mato Grosso, the whole region will grow and thrive amazingly, and so will the railroads. The growth will not merely be material. An immense amount will be done in education, using the word education in its broadest and most accurate sense, as applying to both mind and spirit, to both the child and the man. Colonel Rondon is not merely an explorer. He has been, and is now, a leader of the movement for the vital betterment of his people, the people of Mato Grosso. The poorer people of the black country everywhere suffer because of the harsh and improper laws of debt. In practice, these laws have resulted in establishing a system of peonage, such as has grown up here and there in our own nation. A radical change is needed in this matter, and the Colonel is fighting for the change. In school matters, the Colonel was precisely the ideas of our wisest and most advanced men and women in the United States. Cherry, who is not only an exceedingly efficient naturalist and explorer in the tropics, but is also a thoroughly good citizen at home, is chairman of the school board of the town of Newfane in Vermont. He and the Colonel and Kermit and I talked over school matters at length, and were in hearty accord as to the vital educational needs of both Brazil and the United States, the need of combining industrial with purely mental training, and the need of having widespread popular education, which is and must be supported and paid for by the government, made a purely governmental and absolutely non-sectarian function, administered by the state alone, without the interference with, nor furtherance of, the beliefs of any reputable church. The Colonel is also head of the Indian Service of Brazil, being what corresponds roughly with our Commissioner of Indian Affairs. Here also he is taking the exact view that is taken in the United States by the staunchest and wisest friends of the Indians. The Indians must be treated with intelligent and sympathetic understanding, no less than with justice and firmness, until they become citizens absorbed into the general body politic, and must be the wards of the nation, and not of any private association, lay or clerical, no matter how well-meaning. The Sepetuba River was scientifically explored and mapped for the first time by Colonel Rondon in 1908, as head of the Brazilian Telegraphic Commission. This was during the second year of his exploration and opening of the unknown northwestern wilderness of the Mato Grosso. Most of this wilderness had never previously been trodden by the foot of a civilized man. Not only were careful maps made and much other scientific work accomplished, but posts were established and telegraph lines constructed. When Colonel Rondon began the work, he was a major. He was given 2 promotions to Lieutenant Colonel and Colonel, while absent and in the wilderness. His longest and most important exploring trip, and the one fraught with most danger and hardship, was begun by him in 1909 on May 3rd, the anniversary of the discovery of Brazil. He left Apirapoan on that day, and he reached the Madeira River on Christmas, December 25th of the same year, having descended the Gy Parana. The mouth of this river had long been known, but its upper course for half its length was absolutely unknown when Rondon descended it. Among those who took part under him in this piece of exploration were the present Captain Amilcar and Lieutenant Lyra, and two better or more efficient men for such wilderness work it would be impossible to find. They acted as his two chief assistants on our trip. In 1909 the party exhausted all their food, including even the salt, by August. For the last 4 months they lived exclusively on the game they killed, on fruits and wild honey. Their equipage was what the men could carry on their backs. By the time the party reached Madeira, they were worn out by fatigue, exposure, and semi-starvation, and their enfeebled bodies were racked by fever. The work of exploration accomplished by Colonel Rondon and his associates during these years was as remarkable as, and in its results, even more important than, any similar work undertaken elsewhere on the globe at or about the same time. Its value was recognized in Brazil, yet it received no recognition by the geographical societies of Europe or the United States. The work done by the original explorers of such a wilderness necessitates the undergoing of untold hardship and danger. Their successors, even their immediate successors, have a relatively easy time. Soon the road becomes so well beaten that it can be travelled without hardship by any man who does not venture from it, although if he goes off into the wilderness for even a day, hunting or collecting, he will have a slight taste of what his predecessors endured. The wilderness explored by Colonel Rondon is not yet wholly subdued, and still holds menace to human life. At Caceres, he received notice of the death of one of his gallant subordinates, Captain Cardozo. He died from beriberi, far out in the wilderness along our proposed line of march. Colonel Rondon also received news that a boat ascending the Gy Parana to carry provisions to meet those of our party who were to descend that stream had been upset, the provisions lost, and 3 men drowned. The risk and hardship are such that the ordinary men, the camaradas, do not like to go into the wilderness. The men who go with the Telegraphic Commission on the rougher and wilder work are paid 7 times as much as they earn in civilization. On this trip of ours, Colonel Rondon met with much difficulty in securing someone who could cook. He asked the cook on the little steamer Nyack to go with us, but the cook, with unaffected horror, responded, "Senor, I have never done anything to deserve punishment." Today's music is a 1919 track from Marion Harris, and it's called A Good Man Is Hard to Find.
My lover man has gone away. I cried my baby.
And now on to our main feature, the continuing story. The Case of Charles Dexter Ward, Chapter 4, Part 4. And yet, after all, it was from no step of Mr. Ward's and Dr. Willett's that the next move in this singular case proceeded. The father and the physician, rebuffed and confused by a shadow too shapeless and intangible to combat, had rested uneasily on their oars, while the typed notes of young Ward to his parents grew fewer and fewer. Then came the first of the month, with its customary financial adjustments, and the clerks at certain banks began a peculiar shaking of heads and telephoning from one to the other. Officials who knew Charles Ward by sight went down to the bungalow to ask why every cheque of his appearing at this juncture was a clumsy forgery, and were reassured less than they ought to have been when the youth hoarsely explained that his hand had lately been so much affected by a nervous shock as to make normal writing impossible. He could, he said, form no written characters at all, except with great difficulty, and could prove it by the fact that he had been forced to type all of his recent letters, even those to his father and mother, who would bear out the assertion. What made the investigators pause in confusion was not this circumstance alone, for that was nothing unprecedented or fundamentally suspicious, nor even the Pawtuxet gossip, of which one or two of them had caught echoes. It was the muddled discourse of the young man which nonplussed them, implying, as it did, a virtually total loss of memory concerning important monetary matters which he had at his fingertips only a month or two before. Something was wrong, for despite the apparent coherence and rationality of his speech, there could be no normal reason for this ill-concealed blankness on vital points. Moreover, although none of these men knew Ward well, they could not help observing the change in his language and manner. They had heard he was an antiquarian, but even the most hopeless antiquarians do not make daily use of obsolete phraseology and gestures. Altogether, this combination of hoarseness, palsied hands, bad memory, and altered speech and bearing must represent some disturbance of malady of genuine gravity, which no doubt formed the basis of the prevailing odd rumours. And after their departure, the party of officials decided that a talk with the senior ward was imperative. So, on the 6th of March 1928, there was a long and serious conference in Mr. Ward's office, after which the utterly bewildered father summoned Dr. Willett in a kind of helpless resignation. Willett looked over the strained and awkward signatures of the cheque, and compared them in his mind with the penmanship of that last frantic note. Certainly the change was radical and profound, and yet there was something damnably familiar about the new writing. It had crabbed and archaic tendencies of a very curious sort, and seemed to result from a type of stroke utterly different from that which the youth had always used. It was strange, but where had he seen it before? On the whole, it was obvious that Charles was insane. Of that there could be no doubt. And since it appeared unlikely that he could handle his property or continue to deal with the outside world much longer, something must quickly be done towards his oversight and possible cure. It was then that the alienists were called in. Doctors Peck and Waite of Providence, and Dr. Lyman of Boston, to whom Mr. Ward and Dr. Willett gave the most exhaustive possible history of the case, and who conferred at length in the now unused library of their young patient, examining what books and papers of his were left in order to gain some further notion of his habitual mental cast. After scanning this material, and examining the ominous note to Willett, they all agreed that Charles Ward's studies had been enough to unseat or at least warp any ordinary intellect, and wished most heartily that they could seize more intimate volumes and documents. But this latter they knew they could do, if at all, only after a scene at the bungalow itself. Willett now reviewed the whole case with febrile energy, it being at this time that he obtained the statements of the workmen who had seen Charles find the Kirwan documents, and that he collated the incidents of the destroyed newspaper items, looking up the latter at the Journal office. On Thursday the 8th of March, Doctors Willett, Peck, Lyman and Waite, accompanied by Mr. Ward, paid the youth their momentous call, making no concealment of their object and questioning the now acknowledged patient with extreme minuteness. Charles, although he was inordinately long in answering the summons, and was still redolent of strange and noxious laboratory odours when he did finally make his agitated appearance, proved a far more recalcitrant subject, and admitted freely that his memory and balance had suffered somewhat from close application to his abstruse studies. He offered no resistance when his removal to other quarters was insisted upon, and seemed, indeed, to display a high degree of intelligence, as apart from mere memory. His conduct would have sent his interviewers away in bafflement, had not the persistently archaic trend of his speech, an unmistakable replacement of modern by ancient ideas in his consciousness, marked him out as one definitely removed from the normal. Of his work he would say no more to the group of doctors than he had formerly said to his family and to Dr. Willett, and his frantic note of the previous month he dismissed as mere nerves and hysteria. He insisted that this shadowy bungalow possessed no library or laboratory beyond the visible ones, and waxed abstruse in explaining the absence from the house of such odours as now saturated all his clothing. Neighbourhood gossip he attributed to nothing more than the cheap inventiveness of baffled curiosity. Of the whereabouts of Dr. Allen, he said he did not feel at liberty to speak definitely, but assured his inquisitors that the bearded and spectacled man would return when needed. In paying off the stolid brava, who resisted all questioning by the visitors, and in closing the bungalow which still seemed to hold such nighted secrets, Ward showed no signs of nervousness, save a barely noticed tendency to pause as though listening for something very faint. He was apparently animated by a calmly philosophic resignation, as if his removal were the merest transient incident which would cause the least trouble if facilitated and disposed of at once and for all. It was clear that he trusted to his obviously unimpaired keenness of absolute mentality to overcome all the embarrassments into which his twisted memory, his lost voice and handwriting, and his secretive eccentric behaviour had led him. His mother, it was agreed, was not to be told of the change, his father supplying typed notes in his name. Ward was taken to the restfully and picturesquely situated private hospital maintained by Dr. Waite on Connecticut Island in the Bay, and subjected to the closest scrutiny and questioning by all the physicians connected with the case. It was then that the physical oddities were noticed. The slackened metabolism, the altered skin, and the disproportionate neural reactions. Dr. Willett was the most perturbed of the various examiners, for he had attended Ward all his life, and could appreciate with terrible keenness the extent of his physical disorganization. Even the familiar olive mark on his hip was gone, while on his chest was a great black mole, or cicatrice, which had never been there before, and which made Willett wonder whether the youth had ever submitted to any of the witch-markings reputed to be inflicted at certain unwholesome nocturnal meetings in wild and lonely places. The doctor could not keep his mind off a certain transcribed witch-trial record from Salem which Charles had shown him in the old non-secretive days, and which read, "Mr. G. B., on that night put ye devil his mark upon Bridget S., Jonathan A., Simon O., Deliverance W., Joseph C., Susan P., Methotable C., and Deborah B. Ward's face, too, troubled him horribly, till at length he suddenly discovered why he was horrified. For above the young man's right eye was something which he had never previously noticed, a small scar or pit, precisely like that in the crumbled painting of old Joseph Kirwan, and perhaps attesting some hideous ritualistic inoculation to which both had submitted at a certain stage of their occult careers. While Ward himself was puzzling all the doctors at the hospital, a very strict watch was kept on all mail addressed either to him or to Dr. Allen, which Mr. Ward had ordered delivered at the family home. Willett had predicted that very little would be found, since any communications of a vital nature would probably have been exchanged by messenger. but in the latter part of March there did come a letter from Prague for Dr. Allen, which gave both the doctor and the father deep thought. It was in a very crabbed and archaic hand, and though clearly not the effort of a foreigner, showed almost as singular a departure from modern English as the speech of the young ward himself. It read, Kleinstrasse, 11, Altstadt, Prague, 11th of February, 1928. Brother, in Almonsin, Metraton. I this day received ye mention of what came up from the salts I sent you. It was wrong, and means clearly that ye headstones had been changed when Barnabas got me the specimen. It is often so, as you must be sensible of from the thing you got from ye King's Chapel ground in 1769, and what H got from Oldie Burying Point in 1690 that was like to end him. I got such a thing in Egypt 75 years gone, from which there came the scar ye boy saw on me in 1924. As I told you long ago, do not call up that which you cannot put down, either from dead salts or out of ye spheres beyond. Have ye words for laying at all times ready, and stop not to be sure when there is any doubt of whom ye have. Stones are all changed now in 9 grounds out of 10, and you are never sure till you question. I this day heard from a H, who has had trouble with the soldiers. He is like to be sorry Transylvania is passing from Hungary to Romania, and would change his seat if the castle weren't so full of what we know. But of this he hath doubtless writ you. In my next sending there will be somewhat from Hill Tomb, from ye east, which will delight you greatly. Meanwhile, forget not I am desirous of B. F., if you can possibly get him for me. You know G. in Philadelphia better than I. Have him up first, if you will, but do not use him so hard he will be difficult, for I must speak to him in ye end. Yogg-Sothoth, Neblodzin, Simon O. To Mr. J. C. in Providence. Mr. Ward and Dr. Willett paused in utter chaos before this apparent bit of unrelieved insanity. Only by degrees did they absorb what it seemed to imply. So the absent Dr. Allen, and not Charles Ward, had come to be the leading spirit at Pawtuxet. That must explain the wild reference and denunciation in the youth's last frantic letter. And what of this addressing of the bearded and spectacled stranger as Mr. J. C.? There was no escaping the inference, but there are limits to possible monstrosity. Who was Simon O.? The old man Ward had visited in Prague 4 years previously? Perhaps. But in the centuries behind there had been another Simon O. Simon Orne, alias Jebediah of Salem, who vanished in 1771, and whose peculiar handwriting Dr. Willett now unmistakably recognised from the photostatic copies of the Orne formulae which Charles had once shown him. What horrors and mysteries, what contradictions and contraventions of nature had come back after a century and a half to harass old Providence with her clustered spires and domes. The father and the old physician, virtually at a loss what to do or think, went to see Charles at the hospital and questioned him as delicately as they could about Dr. Allen, about the Prague visit, and about what he had learned of Simon or Jebediah Orne of Salem. To all these inquiries, the youth was politely non-committal, merely barking in his hoarse whisper that he had found Dr. Allen to have a remarkable spiritual rapport with certain souls from the past, and that any correspondent the bearded man might have in Prague would probably be similarly gifted. When they left, Mr. Ward and Dr. Willett realized to their chagrin that they had really been the ones under catechism, and that without imparting anything vital himself, the confined youth had adroitly pumped them of everything the Prague letter had contained. Doctors Peck, Waite, and Lyman were not inclined to attach much importance to the strange correspondence of young Ward's companion, for they knew the tendency of kindred eccentrics and monomaniacs to band together, and believed that Charles or Allen had merely unearthed an expatriated counterpart, perhaps one who had seen Orne's handwriting and copied it in an attempt to pose as the bygone character's reincarnation. Allen himself was perhaps a similar case, and may have persuaded the youth into accepting him as an avatar of the long-dead Kirwan. Such things had been known before, and on the same basis the hard-headed doctors disposed of Willett's growing disquiet about Charles Ward's present handwriting as studied from unpremeditated specimens obtained by various ruses. Willett thought he had placed its odd familiarity at last, and that what it vaguely resembled was the bygone penmanship of old Joseph Kirwan himself. But this the other physicians regarded as a phase of imitativeness, only to be expected in a mania of this sort, and refused to grant it any importance either favourably or unfavourably. Recognising this prosaic attitude in his colleagues, Willett advised Mr. Ward to keep to himself the letter which arrived for Dr. Allen on the 2nd of April from Rochus, Transylvania, in a handwriting so intensely and fundamentally like that of the Hutchinson cipher that both father and physician paused in awe before breaking the seal. This read as follows. Castle Ferenczi, 7th March, 1928. Dear C. Had a squad of 20 militia up to talk about what the country folks say. Must dig deeper and have less heard. These Rumanians plague me damnably, being officious and particular, where you could buy a Magyar off with a drink and food. Last month M. got me ye sarcophagus of ye five sphinxes from ye Acropolis, where he, whom I called up, said it would be. And I have had three talks with what was therein inhumed. It will go to S.O. in Prague directly, and thence to you. It is stubborn, but you know ye way with such. You show wisdom in having less about than before, for there was no need to keep the guards in shape and eating off their heads, and it must be much to be found in case of trouble. As you too well know, you can now move and work elsewhere with no killing trouble if needful, though I hope no thing will soon force you to so bothersome a course. I rejoice that you traffic not so much with those outside, for there was ever a mortal peril in it, and you are sensible of what it did when you asked protection of one not disposed to give it. You excel me in getting ye formula, so another may save them with success. But Borellis fancied it would be so, if ye just right words were had. Does ye boy use em often? I regret that he grows squeamish, as I feared he would when I had him here nigh 15 months, but am sensible to know how to deal with him. You can't say him down with ye formula, for that will work only upon as ye other formula hath called up from salts. But you still have strong hands, and knife, and pistol, and graves are not hard to dig, nor acids loath to burn. O says you have promised him B.F. I must have him after. B goes to you soon, and may he give you what you wish of that dark thing below Memphis. Employ care in what you called up, and beware of ye boy. It will be ripe in a year's time to have up ye legions from underneath, and then there are no bounds to what shall be ours. Have confidence in what I say, for you know O, and I have had these 150 years more than you to consult these matters in. Nefru, car nigh Hadoth, EDWH. For J. Kirwan, Esquire, Providence. But if Willett and Mr. Ward refrained from showing this letter to the alienists, they did not refrain from acting upon it themselves. No amount of learned sophistry could controvert the fact that the strangely bearded and spectacled Dr. Allen, of whom Charles's frantic letter had spoken as such a monstrous menace, was in close and sinister correspondence with two inexplicable creatures whom Ward had visited in his travels, and who plainly claimed to be survivals or avatars of Kirwan's old Salem colleagues, that he was regarding himself as the reincarnation of Joseph Kirwan, and that he entertained, or was at least advised to entertain, murderous designs against a boy who could scarcely be other than Charles Ward. There was organized horror afoot, and no matter who had started it, the missing Allen was by this time at the bottom of it. Therefore, thanking heaven that Charles was now safe in the hospital, Mr. Ward lost no time in engaging detectives to learn all they could of the cryptic, bearded doctor, finding whence he had come and what poor Tuxick knew of him, and, if possible, discovering his present whereabouts. Supplying the men with one of the bungalow keys which Charles yielded up, he urged them to explore Allen's vacant room, which had been identified when the patient's belongings had been packed, obtaining what clues they could from any effects he might have left about. Mr. Ward talked with the detectives in his son's old library, and they felt a marked relief when they left it at last, for there seemed to hover about the place a vague aura of evil. Perhaps it was what they had heard of the infamous old wizard whose picture had once stared from the panelled overmantel, and perhaps it was something different and irrelevant. But in any case, they all half-sensed an intangible miasma which centred in that carven vestige of an older dwelling, and which at times almost rose to the intensity of material emanation. That's it for today. Opening music provided by Victor Valdez from the Symbol Project. This file is released under an attribution, non-commercial, share-alike license. Until next time.
CthulhuPodcast.co.uk